Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The first state is moving to ramp up COVID-19 testing with hopes of quadrupling its capacity now that a key hurdle has been cleared.
The main challenges, and this is experienced by other states, is just having the testing supplies available. The supply chain was an issue.
We chat with Dr. Rick Hong of the State Division of Public Health about the state's testing plan. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also revisit ongoing efforts to bolster historic preservation in Newcastle County and learn how the Freeman Stage is dealing with the COVID-19 crisis in our arts playlist. Plus, Enlighten Me addresses the much-hyped murder hornet. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The state partnered with Nanticoke Hospital Thursday to host the first testing event using saliva-based tests made by the company Curative. The state purchased 200,000 of these test kits. They require patients to register online and are processed by Curative. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with Dr. Rick Hong of the Division of Public Health about these new tests and how they fit into the state's plan to more than quadruple monthly testing as it moves toward gradual reopening.
The online registration, what's the use of that? And do you need to register online in order to get testing?
So again, this is part of the, I guess, trial process. This specific testing has the advantages of online registration. We are developing a on-site registration piece, but we also want to see, again, using this type of testing, what are the advantages and disadvantages.
Okay, to having the online pre-registration.
Correct.
Let's say the online registration thing goes well. Would there ever be a situation in which you need to register online to access testing in Delaware?
So this is tied to the test, the online. I think that's one of the efficiencies attached to this test. I know that not everyone can register online, but we have other testing modalities to address other access barriers, whether it's email or internet access or it's transportation barriers as well, too. So we have many different strategies for testing, and depending on what the focus is, that will lead to the type of testing we will provide.
Okay. And regarding the general increase in testing plan of ramping up to 80,000 tests per month, can you just stress what were the bottlenecks to getting to that point and how are you eliminating them now to be able to increase?
I think the main challenges, and this is experienced by other states, is just having the testing supplies available. The supply chain was an issue, but we're very fortunate that we've been working closely with our partners as well as the federal government to open up those supply chains. So really, I think our major challenge was getting supplies into the state.
Okay, and I know having the capacity and supplies to process the tests is one thing, and then having like the manpower to administer the tests is another. Were those also limiting factors or less so?
I think we've been fortunate enough with Delaware that we have a close relationship with our healthcare partners, whether they're health systems, whether they're FQHCs, whether they're volunteer groups, that staffing was not necessarily an issue. But you are correct that from the supply chain perspective, it's not just the specimen collection kits or the swabs. It's also the reagents need to process the test in the lab. So there are many factors involved. Staffing, I think, is a smaller component of challenges that we've encountered versus some of the other issues that probably played a bigger role, such as supplies.
One thing I was curious about with the saliva-based tests, it sounds like it would be less labor-intensive to administer. Do you necessarily need one nurse to be administering every test?
So we would like to provide a healthcare worker on site to provide any guidance as needed. We do have educational materials to allow the client to swab by himself or herself. So there are videos available. There's paper instruction forms as well, too. So we're doing everything we can to help the client succeed in getting a good enough specimen for testing.
So I guess, can one healthcare worker administer more tests when it's the saliva one versus the nasopharyngeal one?
So the healthcare worker in this process is really just to be available as needed. Since the clients are self-swabbing, you don't need a healthcare provider involved in every single specimen collection versus the nasopharyngeal or the oropharyngeal swab collection where a healthcare provider needs to be involved in every interaction.
Mm-hmm. So on the curative tests, how accurate do you see these tests being compared to the PCR tests you were using before?
So that's a good question. So any new test method that we are interested in acquiring, we go through our internal validation process, regardless if there's an EUA already in place or not. We want to see how it works. There are other factors involved. It's not just whether it's accurate, but can we implement effectively and efficiently. So, you know, this test has gone through other validation, has gone through a validation process that every other test that we acquired has gone through as well, too. And it did comparatively well with our PCR testing. So we're very comfortable in its accuracy.
Okay. Can you give me a sense for whether the different types of testing that DPH is deploying now, are there ones that you're more concerned with false negatives versus false positives or anything like that?
Yeah, I think across the board, just because it's a PCR test, that all of them have a false negative rate, and we are very concerned that might impact the outcome of the results. So, you know, healthcare providers are very well aware that the clinical judgment is still very important in diagnosing COVID-19, that, you know, we do need our clinical providers involved in that process. So it's not simply negative, you're fine, and positive, you're not fine. There needs to be that clinical judgment piece and that interpretation of the test.
So are the curative saliva-based tests versus the nose or oral throat swab, are they processed in the same way and use the same reagents, and it's just a different collection method?
No, so that's a very good question. So one of the reasons why we liked the curative test is they uses a totally different process. So we're not competing with our own cells, with ourselves, in terms of using the similar reagents that we need for the other tests. So that's why it's such a great method that we adopt in Delaware. So it uses a different lab. It uses different reagents. It's a different way of processing. So we can continue to maximize our capacity in our state lab, in our hospital labs, as well as the commercial labs we're dealing with right now. So it just adds to our capability. It does not compete with our capabilities.
And what lab is going to be processing the curative ones?
So it's their own lab. It's in Washington, D.C.
And what's the turnaround time?
So, you know, turnaround time, they, you know, 24 hours, very similar to what we can do state lab. One of the limiting factors will be when they receive the specimens. But once the specimens are received, it can be processed fairly quickly in a couple hours or so.
And I guess that piece about how fast will they be able to receive them is to be seen.
Yeah, and that's why we do want to do this pilot project and, you know, appreciate Nanticoke, who is our hospital partner on this, that we're going to see exactly the logistical piece of it, how to get the specimen collected, can clients do it successfully on their own, are the educational materials effective, how to get it to the lab, and how the reports get received by us as well as the patient, the client. So all this is being looked at. You know, our validation process really just looks at the accuracy, but there's so many other pieces in the testing process.
Mm-hmm. Looking bigger picture at the whole testing plan of that 80,000 per month goal, how would that be distributed geographically? How much employer-based or hospital-based or community event-based?
So it's a good question. And, you know, really we are looking at priorities. There's always a prioritization process to determine who gets tested first. So we may look at, you know, focus on healthcare providers still. You know, we are looking at universal testing in long-term care facilities. We're looking at frontline workers, so those that cannot social distance in essential businesses is also a key factor. Also vulnerable populations like our migrant farm workers, homeless population as well. So we're kind of not focused on one particular aspect because I think there are many vulnerabilities and challenges with each population that I listed. So we want to make sure we have a testing strategy for each group.
Do you have a plan in terms of this amount going to be allocated to this group, X is going to be allocated to this county?
So I think the allocation is not based on percentage of the test. It's really based on what test method fits best for that situation. So there are certain situations where the saliva-based test modality would be better because of the fact is, you know, you may have a population that has more online access. Maybe we don't need as many healthcare providers or workers involved in that process. So there's definitely advantages to that versus the other test processes where the hospitals are very comfortable and familiar with the nasopharyngeal swab testing, so they may stick with that. They have healthcare providers and staffing available at those sites. So, you know, again, it's going to be like determining the logistical pieces to each type of test method and linking that to the appropriate populations.
As of now, what's the criteria for testing?
So at this point, there are many different types of criteria. We are still focusing on symptomatic clients, but we also understand the risk for asymptomatic spread, particularly in certain vulnerable populations, such as the long-term care facilities. Also, we're concerned about the ability or inability to follow infection control measures. So those that cannot social distance at home, for instance, or those that have other barriers to allow them to protect themselves and their family safely. So it's not just about illness, it's also the ability to limit transmission of disease, and that's also a priority.
Mm-hmm. How much discretion does the healthcare worker doing the test have?
Good question. So certain sites have different screening processes. So certain sites are geared more towards certain populations, and at other sites, for instance, when DPH sets up a community site, typically that's for anyone who wants to be tested. But hospitals, they have a different mission, and they may be focused more on symptomatic cases. So, you know, that's why we have our website on www.de.gov/coronavirus. We do have a testing website, so it kind of gives you explanation of each site's capability. Again, depending on the population, it's also going to impact the logistics of it. For instance, you don't want to mix sick people with not sick people because that's going to induce spread. So we do ask the public to be very careful of which site you're going to, and please review the testing website available.
Thanks to our Sophia Schmidt and Dr. Rick Hong of the Delaware Division of Public Health for joining us on The Green this week. Next, we return to a story that we covered previously on The Green, efforts to bolster historic preservation efforts in New Castle County, and specifically the battle over one crumbling historic building just north of Middletown. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Efforts to strengthen historic preservation in New Castle County are starting to take shape as the county's Historic Preservation Working Group starts drafting ordinances to address a variety of ongoing issues. The group, which was created nearly a year ago, includes three county council members determined to make progress. Their effort comes as the battle over the fate of the Houston House, a historic home in the village of Bayberry North, just north of Middletown, is closer to being settled by the New Castle County Historic Preservation Board. Contributor Larry Nagengast has been following these issues for us and updates them in a pair of stories available at DelawarePublic.org. He joined me earlier this week to discuss where things stand. Well, let's start with the ongoing battle over that one property, the Houston House. Remind us the situation with it and the surrounding neighborhood. What's going on?
Well, the preservation community views the Houston House matter as another example of what's called demolition by neglect. In essence, what that means in practice is that a developer will acquire a property that includes a historic structure, does little to maintain or preserve it, and then says that that the building has deteriorated so badly that it has to be torn down. And it usually has to be torn down to make way for some sort of a multi-million dollar construction project. Now, in this particular case, we're talking about a 140-year-old farmhouse and barn that are in the village of Bayberry North, outside of Middletown. The developer, the Blenheim Management Company, wants to tear down the structures and then subdivide the land into five lots so it can build more homes there. Now, while preservationists and some residents are upset that the buildings are unlikely to be saved, many residents in the area consider the deteriorating buildings an eyesore and a nuisance, and they would prefer that Blenheim go ahead with its proposal to build the additional homes and to create a small park in the area.
And this is all coming kind of to a head next week during the New Castle County Historic Preservation Board's meeting. What are the kind of key issues that we expect to be dealt with during that meeting to try and bring this to some kind of resolution?
Well, there was a hearing last June, and that covered Blenheim's request made in the early part of last year for a demolition permit. And those issues will be rehashed when the board meets next Tuesday. However, the Historic Review Board never issued a ruling after that first hearing because Blenheim asked them to put a hold on making the decision because Blenheim wanted to build support in the community for its longer-term plans for the property. Now Blenheim has that support and has asked the Historic Review Board to reactivate the process, as it were, and that's why there's going to be the hearing Tuesday, and there are actually going to be two issues discussed. First, this rehash, as I said, of the request for the demolition permit, and secondly, about Blenheim's plans to subdivide the property to build new homes and to add some parkland. And now this is where we start getting into some really interesting issues. At the root of all this is what's called the Record Plan for Bayberry North. And that's a legal document that sets out the location of all the lots, all the roadways, the open space, and so on in the community. Now, there are notes that were made on this part of the plan, and some of these notes state that the Houston House will be maintained and that the land on which it sits will never be subdivided. Now, Blenheim wants to have that plan amended. The preservationists, including the nonprofit Preservation Delaware Incorporated, say that can't be done because it would mean that Blenheim was breaking promises that it made to the county and to the community in order to get its development plan approved more than 15 years ago. And now, layered on top of that, and this makes it even more interesting, is this larger legal issue about separation of powers. And, certainly you heard a lot about that in Washington the last couple of years. But anyhow, the county's land use department, which is part of the executive branch of government, says that it has the authority to approve amendments to record plans. But the preservationists say that they can't do that because the record plan was approved by a vote of the county council, the legislative body. So only the council can make changes to record plans. Lawyers for Blenheim and Preservation Delaware have exchanged some very blistering letters on this topic, and each side is essentially saying that they're the ones that are correct and that the other side doesn't know what they're talking about.
Well, you mentioned the magic word lawyers, and so I'm going to ask this question. Is this likely to be resolved by the Preservation Board, or is this likely going to wind up in court somehow?
Good question. Really a good question. First of all, the Historic Review Board really doesn't have the power to stop a demolition. All it can do is place a 9-month hold on the request so the interested parties can try to find an alternative to demolition. Where that timeline stands right now in this case is kind of muddy, but the fact is that no alternatives have been developed since that hearing last June, so it seems that demolition is going to be inevitable. Now, this larger question involves the subdivision request. Now, one argument the preservationists make is that letting a developer build new homes on the site would amount to being a reward for letting this historic structure fall apart. And they say if you permit changes in the record plans that have been approved by the county, that would destroy the public's trust in these plans. I mean, after all, if a developer can just go back to the county to request changes, it would make the original promises seem somewhat empty. So the aspect of the hearing now that really gets interesting is, what happens here? The board could let the demolition go ahead, but it doesn't have to endorse the plan to build new homes. But the land use department could conceivably overrule the Historic Review Board. And again, given this separation of powers issue, the county council could wind up getting involved in this again as well. So get back to your original question. Is a lawsuit possible? Yeah, it's possible. But there are plenty of different things that could happen in the meantime that are going to cloud the situation even more.
So to try to avoid this type of battle in the future, last year a new group was formed, the Historic Preservation Working Group, and it's been trying to affect change in this area. And it seems like they want some sweeping change. What are some of the things that they're trying to do to kind of avoid this type of battle again sometime down the road?
Okay. Well, this working group, which includes 3 members of the county council, representatives of several county departments, including land use, and an array of preservation advocates, is currently looking at a collection of possible ordinances. Some of these ordinances have already been introduced. Others are in draft form right now. Most of them, in one way or another, do relate to this concept of demolition by neglect. Let me give you a quick rundown of what they're looking at. To specifically address the demolition by neglect topic, there's a proposal that would clarify and extend these deadlines for reviewing demolition permits. Currently, that 9-month delay that I mentioned starts when the developer makes the permit application for the demolition. The proposed change wouldn't start that clock tick ticking until after the historic review board holds a hearing on the request. So that's one possible change. Then Councilwoman Dee Durham, who launched the working group, is drafting an ordinance that would require not only annual inspections of historic structures, but would also require county inspectors to write up any code violations that they see during these inspections, follow up to make sure that the violations are corrected, and then for the county to prepare, for the county employees to prepare an annual report that they would send to the historic review board and to the county council to describe all of the violations that they found during the course of the year. Another item, Councilman David Carter, in response to this whole Houston House matter, would establish new standards for the preservation of historic structures or sites that are located within an area that is part of a land development or a subdivision plan. Carter's proposal would require that any historic resource that has been identified to be retained be given an H category zoning. That means H standing for historic. Either before the plan is recorded or at the latest when the plan is legally recorded. Now, part of that plan would have to include a detailed maintenance program that the Land Use Department would have to approve in advance to ensure that structural components are protected and reinforced to reduce the potential for demolition by neglect. And now, on top of that, the members of the working group are talking about things like property tax exemptions or reductions to owners of historic properties, and a proposal that would have the county design commemorative plaques that property owners could purchase and then mount alongside the front door of their buildings, a way of giving recognition for the preservation of these historic structures.
But this group is getting some pushback from the Land Use Department. What is it saying in response?
Well, Rich Hall, the county's land use manager, sent an email to the working group 2 weeks ago. He acknowledges that some new laws and strong policies are needed, but he said that the current approach, and I quote, is over-relying on local legislative actions, some of which we think have marginal benefits or less. Hall would like to see the county include other strategies in the preservation initiatives, things like public-private partnerships and more community involvement. Now, in addition to that, and as part of the process with the working group, the Land Use Department has drafted its own legislation. It's fairly comprehensive in that it addresses many of the items that the working group's proposed ordinances address on an individual basis. However, both Dee Durham and David Carter say that the proposals from land use don't go as far and aren't as strong as the working group would like. And the preservationists in the working group, people like Preservation Delaware representatives and so on, also seem to be pretty much in agreement with that. They'd like to see actions that are more in line with what the council members are thinking about than what land use has on the table right now.
Despite this kind of back and forth and friction over these issues, is it fair to say at this juncture that in essence something is better than nothing, that the status quo really just encourages demolition by neglect? And so just getting something, even if you don't get everything you want, is better than just letting things stay as they are?
You're absolutely right about that. Many of the people that I've spoken to here said, at some point here, we're going to have to agree to disagree, that we're not going to have agreement on everything. In any case, this is pretty much what this whole Houston House battle exemplifies. It's fair to say that the county laws don't provide sufficient incentives to encourage preservation, nor do they include sufficient tools to prevent property owners from letting structures of historic significance deteriorate to the point that they must be torn down. In the case of the Houston House, preservation promises were made, but next to nothing has been done in the past 10 years or so to preserve or protect the structures. So, while it might be argued that the developer willfully or neglectfully caused the problems with Houston House, it's also fair to say that the county was responsible for letting it happen. And it's also fair to question the county's commitment to preservation if it continues to let developers tear down historic buildings so that they can make more money by putting up new ones. Now, to prevent similar situations from recurring in the future, that's what the working group is trying to do. And there are going going to have to be changes, changes in the laws, changes in enforcement techniques, and probably changes in the levels of community awareness as well. In this context, I'm going to be a little bit bold here, and I'm going to suggest a possible solution. And I'm not saying that it's going to get any credence with anybody, but let's just say, you know, the farmhouse is in pretty bad shape. So let's assume that that's going to be demolished. But, you know, instead of building new homes, what if Blenheim just goes and creates a bigger park on the site than it is planned? And say it calls it the Houston House Park and puts up a marker that tells the story of the farmhouse. You do something like that, and what happens? The current residents get rid of an eyesore. The developer creates an added value to the neighborhood, and the county appears to be acting in the community's best interest by memorializing some of its heritage. Is it possible? Yeah, maybe it's possible, but it's going to take quite a while before we find out. As I was pulling all this together, I couldn't help but think of that that old Joni Mitchell song, "You don't know what you've got until it's gone."
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. You can read his reporting on historic preservation in Newcastle County and the battle over the Houston House at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist and a look at what the Freeman Stage is doing to cope with the coronavirus pandemic. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Freeman Stage in Selbyville, like many arts and performance venues, is feeling the effects of the COVID-19 crisis. Its concert season this summer is on hold. The Freeman Stage was scheduled to announce the lineup for its 13th season in March, but was forced to hit the pause button because of the pandemic. The Joshua M. Freeman Foundation hosts the Freeman Stage, and its executive director, Patty Grimes, says despite the inability to host live music for crowds at its open-air venue, the Freeman Stage is continuing to bring the arts to its audience via social media. Grimes joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist to discuss their virtual efforts and potential plans for live shows this summer.
Talk to me about the Joshua M. Freeman Foundation, which you are the executive director of. How does that relate to the Freeman Stage?
So the Joshua Freeman Foundation is the actual public charity, the name of the public charity, and our program is the Freeman Stage. And for those who may not be familiar with the Freeman Stage is an outdoor venue located in Selbyville, Delaware, which is actually it's in the Bayside community. It is open for everyone, and we are celebrating our 13th year here, and we not only do live programming during the summer, but we have an arts access initiative where we bring arts education to all of the schools in Sussex County as well. So we are programming arts 365 days a year, Kelly.
You know, let me tell you, I just have to interject and help you promote the Freeman Stage a little bit. I've been to many concerts there. This is a fabulous, fabulous venue. And I'm really missing the Freeman Stage as of late. You know, the stay-at-home mandates from the governor have impacted a wide range of businesses throughout the nation. Many large events in Delaware have been canceled because of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The Freeman Stage has not escaped this. You guys, Patty, were scheduled to announce your 13th season lineup in mid-March, but then the pandemic happened. So what's happening now? Are we ever going to get a lineup again for you guys?
Isn't that the question everyone is asking? Are we going to have a lineup? Are we going to get back out? What's the new normal going to be? So here's what we can say. Here's what we know. Our commitment to this community is to be a vessel that can provide arts. So once we know what the guidelines are going to be, then we are committed to figuring out how we can program a season, a week, a year at the Freeman Stage that can support the community safely and you know, what we know are the arts bring healing to and hope to community. I think we all need the arts, and it also feeds our souls. So we are working on some revisions to what our program is going to be. As you said earlier, we were going to announce mid-March. We have it. We have a whole season ready to go, and most likely that program as it was initiated is not going to occur given the pandemic. And so, you know, the nice thing about being in a business 13 years, you know, we know how to program small community events. And if that is what's going to be sized for post-COVID-19, that's what we'll be able to provide to the community.
Yeah, as you just said, the season was originally slated to begin in just a few weeks, Memorial Day weekend. It's currently been pushed back. The organization, the Joshua M. Freeman Foundation, currently working to reschedule several performances. If you get performances in, Patty, this summer, late in the summer, do you think it will be the same lineup as would have been announced initially?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, we never announced what that lineup was going to be.
Right.
I would highly doubt, Kelly, that all of those performances would be able to come to the Freeman stage this year, knowing that capacities are going to be cut back to accommodate physical distancing. And also, because we do have touring artists, there are some artists who have decided not to tour this year for their own health and safety. Mm-hmm. So although we like to stay really focused on what's happening at the Freeman stage, we are impacted nationally and regionally by the touring artist community as well.
All right. So I understand that in the meantime, with all the COVID-19 pandemic stuff going on and you not being able to bring artists in to perform, Freeman Stage is continuing to bring the arts to its patrons via social media. You've started a series, The Stage is Yours, on your Facebook page. Talk to me about that. What's that all about?
Yeah, so in the summer, we have this program that's called Locals Under the Lights, and it's a place where local artists actually send in, you know, basically a YouTube or video, and we have locals come to grace our stage. And we thought, wow, well, in this period where everyone seems to be on social media and has a little bit of time, let's bring great talent to our 30,000 plus Facebook audience members. And so we started a program called The Stage is Yours. It's been wildly popular, and it's really awesome to see the caliber of artists that we have right here on Delmarva. So you can check our Facebook page, which is The Freeman Stage, and see once a week, twice a week, we are showcasing these artists. So that's one aspect of what we're doing to bring live arts. We've also just found some of the most beautiful ways that people can couch surf and, you know, see opera, Broadway. There are so many live arts experiences that people can see free during this pandemic. And so it just, again, I'm going to go back and say, arts are a great healer, and the fact that people have access to this right now, I encourage your audience members to please, you know, check us out at Facebook and all of our social media places so that you can link into a Broadway musical or, you know, Lincoln Center and see the Metropolitan Opera or symphonic music or jazz. So it's a different time where people are sharing great things. So I recommend that. And then because we believe in the power of the arts and what the impact that they bring for children, we continue our arts and education program online with our weekly dose of the arts. And that has links from grades K to all the way up to high school. So whether you're at home and you are supporting your child and they need a break and you need a break, there are activities as well with this weekly dose of arts that celebrate arts and give some arts lessons. And then we're also going to do a virtual art lesson, I think, starting next week with local artist John Donato. So we are trying to pack it in virtually while people have time at home to enjoy the arts until such time we can be together at the Freeman Stage.
It's almost like you're busier now online than you would be during a normal season. Patty, do you know, I find it fascinating that, you know, just with everything you just talked about in the last minute and a half, 2 minutes, that I can sit home in my pajamas and find all this great music online and listen to a concert, you know, while I'm at home in my pajamas or out on my deck. This is just great, everything you are doing. We want to remind everybody we're talking to Patty Grimes. Patty is the executive director of the Joshua M. Freeman Foundation. They run the Freeman Stage. The Freeman Stage is a great venue. If you have never been, when this pandemic is over, I'm telling you right now, you have to go to the Freeman Stage. Hey, let's talk about this great news. Freeman Stage is doing a $25 million Patty plan to bring a 4,400-seat performing arts venue to the existing location?
Yes, it's actually the location is adjacent to the existing location, and that is really a big thank you to the community. When we started in 2008 and we brought the Freeman Stage and the arts to this area, it was somewhat of a social experiment because the arts were not that available back in 2008, and really, the community has responded with such great support that we have, in the past, we've had performances that are sold out. We've been able to bring national recording artists. We've been able to expand our diversity of arts and genres, and that is because the public has supported it. And so in that vein, we've run out of space, and this new facility will provide the opportunity for us to grow our arts programming and for the ever-growing population in Sussex County, Worcester County, you know, really within a 45-minute drive to come and still have a great informal outdoor arts experience.
Yeah, I think that's a great problem to have, to run out of space and have, you know, room for expansion. Has work on this expansion started yet?
So we are in the design development phase of the project and the capital campaign. It's supposed to be public this year, so it's a way for the public to also financially support that. So we will be in a fundraising stage. As you know, we are a public charity, so we need the support of the public to bring the arts to everyone here. And that is the same with this capital campaign. So on our website, which is freemanstage.org, there are some renderings of what this new facility might look like. And we're very excited to be able to continue to be in the planning stages of the new facility while we continue to present programming at our current location at the Freeman Stage.
This is all such great news. I am so glad I got to speak to you, Patty Grimes. Last question, anything you want the general public to know about Freeman Stage and all the great programming that's going on right now online? Because, of course, Freeman Stage cannot announce this year's lineup thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic.
I just want to say to all your listeners out there is that we miss you. We can't wait to be together again when the time is right at the Freeman Stage. And we are going to continue to provide virtual arts performances until that time. We're going to do the right thing as it relates to focusing on the reopening and working with our state and officials following the CDC guidelines. And just when you think you know what the next step is, you have to go back and pivot. And I think we're all experiencing that in our everyday life. And we're working towards what a summer might be at the Freeman Stage. And Kelly, when we know what that is, I'd love to be back in touch with you so we could share it with your audience.
Thanks to Freeman Foundation Executive Director Patty Grimes and R. Kelly Steele for bringing us this week's Arts Playlist. More information about the Freeman Stage is available at freemanstage.org. And we wrap up The Green Next with Enlighten Me and a look at something that's been big in the news lately, the so-called murder hornet. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Recently, Asian giant hornets have quickly gained fame, or infamy, in the U.S., as reports that a couple of these so-called murder hornets, capable of wiping out an entire beehive, were found dead in the Pacific Northwest. What threat might they pose to Delaware's growing beekeeper community and their prized hives? Delaware Public Media's Mark Fowler has more in this week's Enlighten Me.
Kathy Hostler of Smyrna is a beekeeper. She sells the honey they make, and the beeswax can be used to make soap. Currently, Hostler is president of the Delaware Beekeepers Association.
Keep the bees in my backyard, and I first became interested in beekeeping when I had read about colony collapse disorder. And I'd always been interested in bees as insects because their biology is so interesting and their social system, you know, having, you know, one queen and all of the workers. I found that, you know, fascinating to try to understand why they would be that way.
Sure.
I took a beekeeping class that was offered by the Delaware Beekeeping Association. They offer them every January, and that gave me basically what I needed to know to start keeping bees. And so I guess it's been about 5 years now that I've been keeping bees, and they're a good topic of conversation.
Absolutely.
My kids are kind of embarrassed sometimes proud, depending on, you know, what day of the week it is. They don't bother my neighbors. They forage in the neighborhood. One of my neighbors actually said that once I started keeping bees, that his vegetables actually did better because of the increase in pollination.
Well, that's what they do, right?
That is what they do.
Well, Kathy, when you heard about the murder hornets, what went through your mind?
I actually had known about the Asian hornets, you know, for a while. I teach classes about beekeeping, and one of the videos that I love to show my students was the National Geographic had some footage of a Japanese hornet attacking a beehive, and within a half hour, you know, they had decimated, you know, they'd cut all their little heads off.
It's a gruesome demise for the bees, and the giant hornet has been known to be harmful to humans. After all, it's almost as big as the palm of your hand. They've turned up on Vancouver Island in Canada and in Washington State, but not in numbers of great concern. Doug Tallamy is professor of entomology at the University of Delaware.
The main concern is honeybees. At the end of the season, when they're rearing their queens, they become really predacious, and they focus on honeybees. They have a curious behavior, but the honeybees have a defense, too. What they do is they send out scouts. The scouts will find a colony. And then the scout goes back and recruits other members of its hive. Their hive's not very big, but if three or four of these, we'll just call them the giant Asian hornet. That's a little bit more accurate. If they get to a hive, they can decimate it. They snip the heads off the bees, and they carry the thorax back, and then they feed that to their developing larvae. The Japanese honeybee has an interesting defense in that they don't want those scouts to go back to the hive. So if a scout enters a hive, they swarm it. You get a couple hundred bees surrounding this hornet. They can't sting it to death because its cuticle is too thick. So what they do is they buzz. They rev up their thoracic muscles and create this audible buzz, which generates heat. And essentially, they cook it to death. They can raise the temperature of that ball of bees to 116 degrees, and the hornet dies at 111 degrees. So it's a really curious defense. And, you know, sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. If they don't succeed, the colony is typically wiped out. I don't believe our European honeybees, that's the one we have here, have that defense. I don't think they can do that. Not sure about that, but I don't think that's been demonstrated here because they've never encountered this giant hornet before.
This is also a hornet that's several inches long, and anybody who's been stung by a bee might the effects of an encounter with this murder hornet cause us humans difficulties?
Well, it is big. It's the largest hornet in the world, and it does pack a powerful sting. If you get stung, but we want to look at risk assessment here. The chances of being stung are very slim. The colonies are small. So you would have to stumble across a colony accidentally. And you'd have to be very unlucky, in other words. And so that happens. But you know how many people honeybees kill every year? I mean, they're they're aggressively protecting their hive as well. So I object to the, here's how it got its name, murder hornet. Mm-hmm. And I object to sensationalizing nature like that, because that's just what it is. If we really want to label an animal murder, let's call the house cat a murder cat, because it kills 2 to 3 billion birds a year. And we don't seem to care about that. But, you know, oh, we got a hornet up. Got to sensationalize it.
Professor Tallamy does not expect the murder hornet to even show up this far east, much less turn out to be a threat.
No, there's nothing a Delaware beekeeper should be worried about at this point. My feeling is that they're going to eradicate it in Washington, and it won't move any farther east. Because they're discrete little colonies, it's not like a typical invasive species that an individual can go and reproduce hundreds. These are well-organized colonies in single places all season long. They're easy to track down. And I'm pretty certain, particularly with all the attention they've gotten and the power of social media, if people see them, you can help track them down. But we'll find the colonies. There's probably just a few, and wipe them out. So if I were a Delaware beekeeper, I wouldn't worry 2 minutes about it.
There's plenty else for a beekeeper such as Kathy Hosler to be concerned about, such as the varroa mite.
The varroa mite is like a tick for bees. But imagine a tick the size of like a guinea pig or a rabbit, you know, attached to your body. They're very large in comparison to the body size of the bee. And they will feed on the bee, and they'll feed even more importantly on the developing larvae. The mite will get inside a cell with a developing bee and lay eggs, and those eggs will hatch, and they'll feed on the developing larvae. And so that larvae can emerge unhealthy. They also transmit a lot of viruses, and they are a major killer of honeybees, not only in Delaware, but, you know, throughout the United States and the world. They're so prevalent. We think that, you know, every colony is infested with them now. And we monitor to make sure that the levels of the mites don't get so high. That's the main job of a beekeeper at this point, is making sure that the parasite load isn't, you know, high enough to kill your bees.
Hosler says beekeeping is growing in popularity, with more people signing up every year for the basic beekeeping class. She's also an instructor now. And she says in Delaware and elsewhere, bees' lives matter.
We're an agricultural state, and we actually have to import bees to deal with, you know, our own fruits and vegetables. There aren't enough local bees, you know, to manage that yet. So that's important. We do still get bees from out of state that come and pollinate. It would be nice if we had, you know, more local bees. They're a great hobby. They're very, you know, they can be very relaxing. And a lot of people really like local honey. It's something that, if you like honey, depending on where the bees have been foraging, the flavor and the color and the texture is going to be pretty different. And so for honey aficionados, local beekeeping is, you know, the best.
Mark Fauser, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Mark, for enlightening us this week. You can learn more about beekeeping and the first aid at the Delaware Beekeepers Association website, DelawareBeekeepers.com. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Mark Fauser, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.